Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production.
Now available on Apple Podcasts,
Podcast One, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
The first degree.
First degree.
First degree.
First degree.
First degree.
First degree.
The first degree.
These things are supposed to happen in movies, not in real life.
You know, as far as we know, he stopped in 91 and he got quiet. And then in 04, it was the 30th year anniversary of Otero's. And he watched it on TV and he read about it in the newspaper. And he said that woke him back up. And that he wanted to go play cat and mouse again is what he calls it. And so he's the one that basically caught himself because he started communicating with the police. And they, you know, threw everything at him to find him. So, of course, they are the ones that caught him. But if he had not come out, he would have never been found. I mean, literally, we would have found this crap in our house when he died.
Welcome to The First Degree, the true crime podcast that you might end up on. My name is Jack Vanek. I'm sitting far away from Alexis Linkletter and Billy Jensen. And today is a very special day. We have part three and the conclusion of our BTK series. So if you haven't listened to parts one and two, stop right now. Go back 2 weeks. And we still have Dennis Rader's daughter, Carrie, with us. And on today's episode, we're going to take you through the most riveting and visceral facets of her experience when she discovered that her father was BTK. But before we jump into all that, I have a very important question to ask. Billy, what day is it?
It's National Chicken Wing Day.
Yes.
What?
Yes.
Is happening.
I know. It is.
I've never been so excited.
And Bill, it's also National Cheese Sacrifice Purchase Day, which I'm not on board with.
Sacrifice cheese in your purchasing is not conducive to this podcast.
No.
Should always be a cheese in your grocery basket.
Yes. It's also International Tiger Day. And it's rain day, and rain is one of my favorite things. So
it's interesting that rain day is in the middle of July.
Mm-hmm.
I guess for the Midwest, it rains, but we're not seeing rain over here on the West Coast. Well, only in California. Okay, rain day.
I don't know. I'm not a huge fan of rain in Los Angeles just because of the critters. We get tons of mosquitoes when there's rain, and the cockroaches come out to play when there's rain.
They do. And we're not used to rain over here. That it's all the stuff
down.
Just gets like pushed up from the underground.
No rain day. Yes, a chicken wing day.
No cheese sacrifice day.
All the cheese, all the time.
I don't. Some person that was allergic to cheese probably made up that day. I don't like it, but you know, that's enough of that. So let's turn down the lights
and turn up your anxiety,
because this could be you.
It was a routine ritual that was meticulously followed by thousands of people who lived in the Wichita area in the 1970s and the 1980s. You arrive at your house and you walk up to the front door, keys in hand. You unlock the door, you step inside, you turn on the lights, and then you run to the phone. You pick up the receiver and you listen for a dial tone. And whether or not you heard that flat, shrill, slightly out of tone hum could mean life or death. And if we're talking death, we're not talking any old ordinary death. We're talking death by ligature strangulation. We're talking hours of torture, being strangled to the brink of death and then allowed to have one gasping breath before being strangled again. We're talking hours of taunting before death. And even once the life is choked out of you, the experience isn't over. There would be pictures of your tied up body that would be taken with a Polaroid. There would be masturbation near your body at the scene. And along with that would come a reeling reaction from the community, a heartbroken family, and a sonic wave of fear that would reverberate through the community. And ultimately, eventually, the person who killed you would write a detailed letter to police, taking credit for your senseless murder. On last week's episode, we took you through the murders of Nancy Fox, Maureen Hedge, Vicki Weggerly, Shirley Vane, and finally, Dee Davis, who would be BTK's final victim. We left off last week with a porcelain mask that Dee was wearing when she was found. Following Dee's murder, the killer would go underground and would be beckoned to reemerge following the years of silence. BTK had fatally flawed narcissism and would essentially rat himself out after a cat and mouse game with police that lasted 3 decades.
So today's case takes us back to January 15th of 2004. The top movie in theaters was Save the Last Dance with Julia Stiles, Sean Patrick Thomas, and Kerry Washington. The song topping the charts was Independent Women by Destiny's Child. It was a good day. And on January 15th of 2004, it marked a very important anniversary. It was 30 years to the day that the unsolved Otero quadruple homicide had occurred. So, in an attempt to keep the pursuit of BTK alive, the Wichita Eagle released an in-depth article in which the original investigators were interviewed. The tone of the article was somber and frustrated because everyone expected BTK to be caught by now.
Right, because by 2004, the police had invested more than 100,000 hours in pursuit of BTK. Over the years, they tried almost everything, and there is no doubt that these horrific murders remained at the forefront of the minds of those who lived through them. But 30 years had passed, which meant that for many, these crimes, and also the fear of BTK, were moving further and further away in the rearview mirror. BTK had not been heard from, which for investigators was both a gift and a curse. It's a gift, obviously, because more people hadn't died. And it seemed as if this BTK problem was now the burden of maybe some other jurisdiction. But it was also a curse because without contact or another crime scene, there were no new threads to pull. No new threads that could help unravel the identity of this monster. So when the Wichita Eagle released this article, no one was expecting to hear from BTK as a result, but they did.
Right, because they had also written one of these articles on the 20-year anniversary, and nothing had happened. So their assumption was, of course, that this guy is gone. But it seemed as though Dennis Rader missed having his moniker in the papers. And we say this because once the Wichita Eagle released their 30-year Otero murder commemorative article, they received a letter from BTK. But he had used the name Bill Thomas Kilman on the return address. And accompanying the letter was a photocopy of victim Vicki Weggerly's driver's license and photos of Vicky's body that had been taken by her killer. Needless to say, the author of the letter took credit for Vicki Weggerly's murder. And this letter was the shot of adrenaline that law enforcement needed to ramp up their efforts and finally catch this guy.
And the same spring that BTK made contact with the media is also when Dennis Rader took his family to a tulip festival in Michigan. And this is proof that he retained his keen ability to deceive everyone around him. He was 59 years old. He was balding. He was out of shape. He was a dog catcher and the president of his church congregation. And on that same road trip with his family, he decided to visit his uncle. The two of them had a lovely day catching up and taking trips down memory lane. Dennis Rader was living a normal life with normal hobbies, normal passions, and a normal family. And he had all of this after he put 10 innocent victims in the ground.
In parts one and two, Carrie, our first degree, Dennis Rader's daughter, expressed the fact that she's never actually met quote-unquote BTK. Because she said, if she had, she'd be dead. But in hindsight, she realizes that she may have been shown glimpses of him over the years.
And so there are two incidents where he was physically abusive towards my brother, where he tried to strangle my brother from the front. When my freshman year in college, we had a falling out and over dinner and the dinner table crashed. He sprung up and tried to strangle my brother and then did it a few years later. So again, in hindsight, looking back, you know, it's taken a long time to be able to process these things, because things you just sort of brushed off or you just forgave, or you thought, well, that's the worst thing my father could ever do, or was out of character, or you realize that's just really the tip of this iceberg of this person. You know, as far as we know, he stopped in 91 and he got quiet. And And then in 04, it was the 30th year anniversary of Otero's, and he watched it on TV and he read about it in the newspaper and he said that woke him back up and that he wanted to go play cat and mouse again is what he calls it. And so he's the one that basically caught himself because he started communicating with the police. And they, you know, threw everything at him to find him. So, of course, they are the ones that caught him. But if he had not come out, he would have never been found. I mean, literally, we would have found this crap in our house when he died.
By 2004, the police had the upper hand in that forensic science had progressed significantly. When BTK was committing his murders, DNA technology was not even close to where it was in 2004. But despite that, investigators collected biological evidence from the scene in the form of not only semen samples, but also scrapings from underneath fingernails of victims like Vicky Wagerly. And under Vicky's nails, they found partial DNA profiles from one unknown male, presumably her killer. And where there is DNA, there is a solvable case. And now all the cops needed was the right suspect. And over the years, the police had accrued a significantly large list of potential suspects. And using the DNA, they went from one suspect to the next and eliminated them.
But now the killer was communicating again. The police were bracing themselves for BTK's next move, and it arrived in the form of a word puzzle that was sent to KAKE-TV, which we're calling Cake TV. And this thing, you can Google it. It looks like a word search game that you would find on a kid's menu at a restaurant. It's a grid with rows and rows of seemingly random letters, but if you start searching diagonally, horizontally, and vertically, words emerge. And it's kind of separated out in sections. And the first section seems to describe how the killer stalks a victim, showing words such as prowl, fallow, fantasies, spot victim, steam builds, and go for it. Another section suggests possible disguises: realtor, insurance, serviceman, fake ID, and handyman.
And these were sort of the ruses he would do when he would approach the door to get in. He'd pretend he was the cable guy, the electrician. Like, that's how he got into the homes during the day, because most of them were during the day. Actually, I think all of them were. So he would have like a ruse. So that's what that's about.
Yeah, and the most surprising finding in the charge may be the numbers 6220. And this would turn out to be the same number as Raider's address in Park City. And this is something actually that Son of Sam used in his letters. He actually gave directions to his house in the form of in the letters encoded. So I think he was definitely looking at other serial killers. We can now link these words and these numbers back to Dennis Raider with meaning. But before his identity was known, these words and numbers were just baffling to detectives. And they didn't know whether there was any significance or whether this was an attempt to push detectives down rabbit holes that would lead nowhere.
Right, because BTK's use of this word puzzle has prompted many people to look for connections between he and that of the Zodiac Killer. So the Zodiac Killer murdered at least 7 people and possibly up to 20 in Northern California between December of 68 and October of 69. And it has remained one of the world's greatest unsolved crimes. The Zodiac nickname was derived from a series of cryptic and taunting letters, which, you know, are kind of reminiscent of what BTK does. But these letters were posted and sent to the media from the San Francisco Bay Area. And these correspondences included ciphers, and only 1 of 4 have been decoded. And there's confusion about whether the other 3 can be decoded or if they're also sort of red herrings for to just make investigators go in circles. But there are some individuals who believe without question that BTK is the Zodiac Killer. And these conclusions are made based on handwriting as well as other commonalities that exist between the Zodiac and BTK correspondences.
Some people also think my dad's the Zodiac. And I'm like, it doesn't match up. Like, you guys are idiots. Like, my dad was overseas in the military. Like, my dad's not the Zodiac, dudes. I'm sorry to tell you that. The taunting and the codes, like the codes, but nothing, the MO doesn't match. And my father was never in California, whatever.
On June 9th of 2004, a month after Cake TV received the word puzzle, a package was found taped to a stop sign at the corner of 2 really busy streets in Wichita. Inside, there was a letter that detailed gruesome descriptions of the Otero murders and a drawing with the words, "The sexual thrill is my bill." And that was written all over it. In the package, there is also a chapter list for a book entitled The BTK Story. And chapter one's title was A Serial Killer is Born.
Yeah, so he's already writing his own story.
Yeah, he's writing his autobiography.
Yeah.
Piece of shit.
A little over a month later in July, another strange package was discovered at the Wichita Public Library. And this package had been slipped into the After Hours book return slot. There were writings inside that contained more bizarre claims, including that BTK was responsible for the death of 19-year-old Jake Allen in Argonia, Kansas, earlier that same month. Now, this claim was actually found to be false, and the teen's death was determined to be death by suicide. But this is odd because it's something new for BTK, because in the past, he would take credit for murders that he actually committed. He had never tried to take credit for something he hadn't actually done before. And it makes you think, is it possible that he did this because at 59 years old, and with the progress of technology and crime scene forensics, it would be a lot harder for BTK to get away with physically perpetrating an actual murder? We don't know.
So 3 months later, at the end of October, another package was found in a UPS drop box. It was a manila envelope containing a series of cards with images of terror and bondage of children pasted onto them. The package, of course, also included a letter. There was a poem threatening the life of the lead investigator who was hunting BTK, and that was Lieutenant Ken Landwehr. And the package also had a false autobiography containing many details about BTK's life, so it claimed. So in the letter, BTK claimed that he was born in 1939, false, not true. His grandfather played the fiddle and died of lung disease, not sure. This would have been in the early 1900s, so it's hard to corroborate that. That his mother dated a railroad detective, possible but unlikely. That he was a veteran, that is true. That he was fascinated with trains, I don't know. Everyone likes trains. Who hates a train?
Love trains.
Exactly. And that he had a Hispanic acquaintance named Petra who had a younger sister named Tina. All right, I guess.
So
possible,
random.
But unlikely. So these details included in the letter were later released to the public to see if they rang bells for anyone in the community. Like, does anyone have anyone who ticks all these boxes? Of course, no one did because most of them are false. And the ones that were true were things like being a veteran, which at that time, his age group, there are more veterans probably than any other age. So it doesn't really do much in the sense of narrowing suspects. So anyways, maybe you like trains. Who really knows what's going on? But either way, it was back to the drawing board for police because they learned nothing as a result of this letter.
Right. And we're going to fast forward 2 months to December of 2004. And this is when police were alerted to the discovery of yet another package in a nearby park. Inside this package was the driver's license of the BTK victim, Nancy Fox, which had been stolen from her home when she was killed. Also inside the box was one of the most chilling pieces of evidence connected to BTK. And this is right on par with the creepy mask that was left on the body of Dolores D. Davis. It was a Barbie doll that was symbolically bound at the hands and feet with a plastic bag tied over its head. And this is mimicking what was done to the majority of BTK's victims.
Unsurprisingly, the media exploded over BTK once again. And media started playing this recording that they had of BTK's voice from when he called the police to lure them to the homicide scene of Nancy Fox. And we're quite sure, just based on what we know, that Dennis Rader was basking in all of this media attention for the bulk of 2004. But that leads us to the question, what was his daughter, Carrie, doing? What did she think of the coverage? And did she listen to this audio clip and recognize her dad's voice?
You know, people are like, how did you never hear it? And I'm like, they never played it when I was older, you know. And then I wasn't in Wichita in 04 when he was playing his cat and mouse game. So I only read like two news articles about it, talked to my mom once. I never heard it. I mean, if I had heard that news, if I had heard that audio clip in 04, I don't think I would have thought it was my dad because that's such a big leap. But I also think that if I had been in Wichita in 04, I like to solve things. I probably would have been trying to figure this out. And this might have been in it a completely different way.
2004 came and went as police scrambled for ways to smoke out this killer's identity. And you have to imagine what they're thinking and the frustration and the pressure. For many years, they believed with certainty that BTK had to be dead or he must have moved. And we say this isn't like a normal serial killer. They used to just think somebody doesn't stop killing, right? But beyond this guy was so engaged with the media, seemingly so addicted in the media attention, so addicted to seeing his name on the screen in the newspapers. He must be dead, because how does someone go from being that obsessed with yourself, that enthralled with being this killer and engaging with not only police, but also the media, to just completely silent? And then suddenly, over a decade goes by, because remember, his last contact was in 91. It's 04. Suddenly, he's back to exactly where he was, the exact same momentum, where every couple months, a package is showing up with a doll or a word puzzle. Like, he's reengaged as if no time had passed at all. And it really is a mind for detectives, because they, at that point, didn't know that killers could stop. So this was rewriting all of the profiling all at the same time. And suddenly, the same species of fear that the community knew in Wichita decades prior was back with a vengeance. Suddenly, people snapped back to checking for cut phone lines the moment they walked in the door.
2005 comes, and it may have been a new year, but BTK was using his same tricks. An eager BTK sent a postcard to Cake TV describing a package he claimed to have left by the side of the road. In this postcard, BTK also asked about the status of another package that he said he left at the Home Depot a few weeks earlier. The roadside package turned out to be a cereal box containing a letter, and it described in sickening detail his first crime, which was the Otero murders in 1974. The box also held some jewelry and a doll with a rope around its neck. The doll was tied to a curved PVC pipe, apparently representing Josephine Otero. But it was BTK's reference to a package at the Home Depot that gave investigators their first big break in this decades-long case. An initial search of the premises turned up nothing from BTK. But a store employee told police that his girlfriend had found a cereal box with writing on it in the bed of his pickup truck about 2 weeks earlier. The employee just thought it was a joke and actually threw the box away.
Right. And the police recovered his trash and they found the box. And thank God that they did, because inside the box were several documents, including one in particular, where BTK asked the police if he could communicate with them via a floppy disk without being traced. Oh my God. And he said, if so, he asked the police to place a newspaper ad saying, quote, "Rex, it will be okay." So, of course, the police could not run this ad fast enough. Running this ad was signaling to BTK that it was, quote unquote, totally safe for him to send a floppy disk to them. And of course, they didn't and couldn't identify him through this disk. So the police crossed their fingers that there'd be something on the disk that would lead them to the killer. And BTK, he's so desperate to communicate with them that he believed them when they said that they couldn't trace him. And this is another classic example of BTK's narcissism outing him. So police also, at the same time, they pull up the surveillance from the Home Depot and they observe an unidentified man in a black Jeep Grand Cherokee pull up alongside the employee's pickup truck where the cereal box was found. So slowly, all these pieces of the puzzle are coming together. And everyone tied to this investigation was on the edge of their seats, waiting and hoping that a floppy disk from BTK would materialize. And 2 weeks later, it does. The disk was sent to a local TV news station, and in the package was also a gold chain, a photocopied cover of a novel about a murderer who bound and gagged his victims, and several index cards, and one of which gave instructions for communicating with BTK through the newspaper.
The police popped this floppy into a computer tower, and on it was one file that contained the message, quote, "This is a test." And it also contained additional instructions for further communication with BTK. So the police looked inside the quote-unquote property section of this document that was saved onto this disk, and they could see that this file had last been saved by somebody named Dennis. Now, this is just a first name. And it could have been a ruse. I mean, this is something BTK had done before. When police searched through the disk, they discovered in a file that had been deleted that the disk had been used at a computer tied to the Christ Lutheran Church. So the police did a Google, as one is to do when they find anything, and they pulled up the church website. And there, on the homepage, on the landing page, more than likely, was a smiling picture of Dennis Rader, president of the congregation. Police quickly learned that Dennis Rader was a code compliance officer for the city of Park City, had an office at City Hall, in fact, located his address, drove past his house, and saw a black Jeep Grand Cherokee in the driveway, the same vehicle that was seen in the surveillance footage outside Home Depot after this cereal box package had been found in the employee's pickup truck. So, we know what happens next. He gets taken into custody. This is huge. This is historic. This is a massive victory for investigators who have been chasing this man, losing sleep over this man, and killing themselves to capture this man for decades. But this, of course, was not a victory for the family of Dennis Rader. What was to come for them was, in essence, life-shattering.
Well, so the FBI comes to the door. It's like one guy. And so part of the problem is they send in an accountant, like an accountant with a badge, not like a criminal guy to me. Not like somebody that knew how to work with crime victims. So he was completely like out of his element too. He was like, do you know a BTK? And I was like, well, I've heard there's like somebody named that back in Wichita. And I was like, I heard he's like strangles women. I was like, oh, I was like, had something happened to my mom or grandma. So I'd like totally freaked out on him. And he was like, no, they're fine, but you can't talk to them. And I was like, well, then how do you know they're fine? He's like, no, they're fine. He's like, your dad's been arrested. And I'm like, what? He like basically just drops this bombshell on me in my kitchen that my dad was BTK. It wasn't like we're questioning him or we're looking at him. Dad is BTK.
Grief is defined as a mental suffering or distress that is caused by loss or affliction, sharp sorrow, or painful regret. And they say that the grieving process hits you in stages.
And so like he's telling me this. First, it was just like the shock of like, you know, when you lose somebody in an accident or if you've lost somebody, you know, in a murder or something like that, unexpected, like that, like I had lost my dad. And then the insanity of like all this stuff's coming out. So I went into like physical shock. I was basically going into physical shock in front of this officer and he didn't do jack shit. You know, like he didn't get me water. He didn't get me a blanket. He didn't get me help. You know, and I was in physical shock for like 5 days. My husband came home. We were young. We were in our 20s. We didn't know anybody in Michigan. So nobody knew I was in physical shock for 5 days. And that's where a lot of my messed up PTSD comes from being in physical shock and nobody knocking me out.
So there's shock and then there's denial.
So I'm trying to alibi my dad. So I'm like telling you like the same thing I told you, all these great things about my dad. And then I'm like trying to get the dates to alibi him.
Then there's bargaining.
And he's like, oh, well, there was one in 86. That was the ninth one, Mrs. Weggerly.
Vicki Weggerly. She was the mother of three who was killed as her children watched from behind a locked bathroom door.
September of 86. And I hadn't ever heard of that one. And I was like, well, we were at Disneyland the month before, you know. And I was like, that's weird. Like to go to Disneyland and then your dad murders somebody, a mom. And then I started, it just, something hit, like it just sunk right into my gut. And if I even sat here and think about it enough, I would do it again, right in, like, right, like how you know something. And I was trying to alibi him that first weekend still. So I made the mistake of getting online and looking up BTK's crimes, even ones that are not his, trying to alibi him. No, that I shouldn't have done that ever. That really messed me up. And that's the first time I heard that audio recording from 77. And when I heard it, I knew it was dad. Again, in hindsight, but I knew that was dad. Because, like, I would go try to alibi him and it would just get worse and worse and worse.
Depression. Reflection. Two more stages.
You know, we're talking to the FBI. They're telling us they're finding this evidence in the house. So you're, like, trying to wrap, like, you go back and forth between dad and BTK, and you're trying to match up the timeline, you know, and you're hearing these horrible things about your father. He's on all the newspapers everywhere. I'm literally sitting like in the airport to fly home in Detroit and he's on those massive screens you know, and he's in his orange jumpsuit. And that's the first time I had seen my dad in an orange jumpsuit. You know, I mean, I'm not ever going to get that image out of my head. And so we got me to Kansas and we got me to my family in northern Kansas. And I met my mom. And when I got around my family, we basically did sort of the funeral thing where you gather all together and you eat like Kentucky Fried Chicken, you know, and you watch like Survivor or something and you just hunker down together. And so after I had slept one night at my uncle's house, I woke up and I was finally done shaking. I literally was physically shaking from Friday till Tuesday morning. So I don't think I ever thought about, oh my God, I mean, there's that, oh my God, how am I going to survive the next 5 minutes? Or how am I going to wake up tomorrow? And I woke up Tuesday morning and I like checked my hand and I was like, it had stopped. And that was the first time I knew I was going to like survive.
So temperatures are rising all over the country. And I don't know about you, but when it is hot outside, the last thing I want to do is be cooking hot food. That's why lately I've been skipping out on meal prep and keeping things easy with Daily Harvest. So right now, Daily Harvest is helping me beat the heat with their refreshing smoothies and delicious Scoops, their new plant-based ice cream. So Scoops are free of additives, preservatives, and fillers because they're made with whole, nourishing, organic ingredients like black sesame, coconut cream, and dragon fruit. And they come in four amazing flavors. Daily Harvest is such a life saver. They help you stock your home with clean, delicious food that's built on real foods, fruits, and vegetables. They're farm frozen to lock in their peak nutrients and taste. And with Daily Harvest, there's tons of options for any time of the day, from smoothies to harvest bowls, flatbreads, and more. And the best part, they're ready to enjoy in minutes. So keep it simple this summer with Daily Harvest. Go to dailyharvest.com and enter promo code FIRST to get $25 off your first box. That's promo code FIRST for $25 off your first box at dailyharvest.com. Again, that is dailyharvest.com with promo code FIRST. Did you know that right now Geico is offering an extra 15% credit on car, motorcycle, and RV policies? That's 15% on top of the money Geico could already save you. So what are you waiting for? Your dog to make you breakfast in bed? As nice as that sounds, it's probably never going to happen. But at least there's never been a better time to switch to Geico. Save an extra 15% when you switch by October 7th. Visit geico.com to learn more.
Prosecutors assigned to the BTK case ended up issuing a subpoena for a tissue sample from a pap smear that was done on Carrie at a student clinic near Kansas State University when she was a student there 5 years earlier. DNA tests on that sample showed that Carrie Rader was the daughter of BTK, further cementing her father's fate.
So when I read that, I was super confused about how I felt about it because it's such a strange thing to do, to kind of put the daughter in the process of nailing her dad, because it is, of course, it's the right thing. And it's like, we got to get this guy off the streets no matter what. But in the honor of our theme, which is like empathy and the family and all of that stuff, like it is something to look at, because using Carrie's DNA to nail him is shitty for her,
I just don't understand what, you know, perfect example, because, you know, we've both worked on GSK. GSK, they monitored him. They followed him. They followed him to Hobby Lobby. They eventually got his trash and were able to do a one-to-one relationship between his DNA and DNA left at the crime scene. I don't understand why they didn't do that here and why they decided to do this.
Well, my theory is, and I consider that, is that so the impact that BTK had on Wichita is not the same that GSK had on any one community. Mm-hmm. Like GSK was not even connected as being GSK. There was the original Night Stalker, there was the East Area Rapist, and there was a Visalia Ransacker until the early 2000s. You know what I mean? Like BTK was BTK from the 1970s. And I think, and they were right, because we will get to this, like with the amount of his correspondence being what it was, I think they could tell. They had John Douglas in their ear as mm-hmm. a profiler. Like he's about to kill. And I think the sense of urgency was a lot different. The subpoena to get this DNA was a very controversial move, but this prosecutor and this, they were all on the same team, and they had been for 4 decades. You know what I mean? Like same DA's office, same police department. Like, I just think it was like, hey, we're going to ask for forgiveness, not permission when we take this, because we're all like aligned in Park City's a super small town too. It's not California. Like, I think they were even more scared in that town than anyone ever had been of GSK.
I thought a very probably an interesting thing that's totally unrelated to like anything that you guys are talking about, because obviously I'm not like a professional true crime person.
You are now, Jacqueline.
No, but my first thought with that is like, what an invasive DNA type of a sample to be taking too, right? It's from a pap smear.
It's very ironic.
And it's like your father is like a sexually motivated serial killer, that is such an it's such an invasive thing to do to somebody. And that was kind of the first thought that I thought when we were sort of talking about that.
The biggest shock I'd ever had. He said the nicest guy in the world. I would have probably gave him a key to watch my dog if I had to when I was leaving town.
Raider, a churchgoer here at Christ Lutheran Church in North Wichita, and not just any member of the church, the president of the Congregation Council.
It's consistent with what we had thought all along, was that it was an individual who blended well into the community, was basically invisible to his neighbors and friends and co-workers because he was just an ordinary guy.
Raider, a compliance officer in Park City. Residents knew him as a stickler for detail.
He'd harass you over your grass, being over, 6 inches tall or something like that.
But Raider also handled animal control. You're about to see a KSN interview shot with Dennis Raider on animal attacks in Park City.
We've been tracking it down. The dogs are somewhat territorial as well as vicious, and we've been trying to round them up and corral them as best we can, working with the reporting parties of where the sheep were killed.
Business reference books dating back to the 70s show Dennis Raider as an ADT security technician. Key, since police have often thought BTK gained access to homes as a utility employee. We've also learned another piece of information about Dennis Raider that matches what police have thought all along about the BTK killer. He has a history with Wichita State University. An alumni book shows Raider graduated WSU in the late 70s. Police linked a BTK letter to a school copy machine, and the brother of victim Catherine Bright reports BTK asked him if he'd seen him around campus. The haunting question now for police and an entire city, does this voice
round him up and corral him as best we can
match this one?
Yes, you will find a homicide at 843 South Pershing.
That, of course, a call police say was made by BTK himself. One member of the Christ Lutheran Church tells me he knew Raider for 20 years and never suspected a thing. Apparently, he was not alone.
So on February 25th, 2005, shortly after noon in Park City, Dennis Raider was taken into custody while he was driving near his home. One of the arresting officers asked, "Mr. Raider, do you know why you're going downtown?" And Raider replied, "Oh, I have suspicions why." Then the FBI and the ATF searched his home and vehicle, and they seized evidence, including computer equipment and a pair of black pantyhose retrieved from a shed. They also searched his church, his office at City Hall, and the main branch of the Park City Library.
As far as Raider's response to being arrested, well, Dennis Raider was genuinely shocked. He asked Lieutenant Landwehr the following at the start of his interrogation. He said, "I need to ask you, how come you lied to me? How come you lied to me?" And Landwehr replied, "Because I was trying to catch you." Landwehr told the ABA Journal that, quote, "he couldn't get over the fact that I would lie to him. He could not believe that I did not want this to go on forever." And most people are aware of the fact that Dennis Raider has never been shy about confessing to his sins. When he was first interrogated, his confession was a 33-hour long marathon in which he revealed each and every detail of his crime in a chilling matter of fact. And he also revealed the location of his quote-unquote motherload of evidence.
And once Dennis Raider went to prison, he was interviewed by the famed profiler John Douglas, as we mentioned. And he also started speaking with and working with forensic psychologist Dr. Kathleen Ramsland. And he started corresponding with her and sharing information with her. And he did this for more than 5 years. And he still talks to her to this day. I do know that based on what Carrie told me. And according to Dennis Rader, he says the reason why he worked with Ramsland was because he wanted her to uncover this thing inside him that made him, quote unquote, go dark, which is his language about what happens to him when he goes into these modes where he needs to kill. And it's this element that he calls Factor X. And to discuss everything uncovered in Rader's confession and everything he shared with Ramsland, it would take months for us to disclose that here. But here are some things that stood out to me as particularly interesting. So Dennis Rader described his ability to compartmentalize his life by calling it, quote unquote, cubing, by drawing a distinct line between his normal life and when he went dark.
Like, my dad was very good at, like, okay, I'm a dad now. Now I'm gardening. Now I'm walking the dog, and his clothes would change. Or now I'm a compliance officer, so I'm wearing a uniform and I have a truck so I can stalk. You know, or now I'm around police, so I'm going to look like more like a police officer. And now I'm at church, so I'm going to wear church clothes and I'm going to act like a church man. Now I'm with my parents, so I'm going to act like a son. But if you think of somebody like my dad or D'Angelo or Bundy or these other guys, they do have the ability to blend in so well. I mean, that's one of their strengths, is their ability to like put on different like masks and clothes. I mean, by mask, I mean like, you know, your human mask.
Rader also confided in Ramsland that as he was growing up, he fantasized about tying women down onto train tracks, which you would see often in old movies and old cartoons. He masturbated to his father's book about the Lonely Hearts Killer. And he personified his impulse to kill by calling it, quote, the Minotaur. When Rader was growing up, he started cutting out slick ads from magazine advertisements. That's what he called it. He would then draw ropes and gags on the pictures, and he pasted them onto these index cards that he would then carry around with him. And he also described his preferred masturbation practices, and he called them motel parties. So he would be alone in a motel room, and he would bind his wrists and ankles, cover his head with a bag, and restrict his breathing, which paralleled what he did to his victims.
Right. And something that I found particularly interesting, but honestly not surprising with BTK, is Dennis Rader came up with these like cute little nicknames for his most disturbing acts. So in Rader's correspondence with Ramsland, he said that whenever he referred to something that he found particularly arousing, such as getting spanked as a child or the image of a helpless woman being bound and gagged, he called it his quote unquote sparky big time. And he also hid trophies from his victims in what he liked to call hidey holes throughout Wichita, which is f-ing insane to me.
So creepy.
Hidey holes?
Sparky big time?
It
makes it so much scarier.
Because it's dumb bro nicknames for things.
No way. He's like a clown serial killer hybrid. It's so disturbing.
No, it's so disturbing. And a lot of Rader's general fantasies focused on women's lingerie, and he particularly liked satin panties that belonged to his victims. At each victim's home, he would take the time to rummage through all their stuff to take specific things that he wanted. And he kept them in his hidey holes, but he also buried some, taped some to bridges, and kept some at his church. But at the time that he shared all this with Ramsland, he couldn't exactly remember where all of his hidey holes were anymore. He also fixated on anything bound or knotted, and he loved abandoned silos, and he referred to them as castles, fantasizing about torturing women within them.
One thing that's really interesting about the silos, when I was doing some of the research, he was referencing how much he loved H.H. Holmes. And H.H. Holmes had a murder castle, and then he's from Kansas. So he thought he was being really unique in that he's like the H.H. Holmes of Kansas. He wants a murder barn with a murder silo, but he was still copying. It's still not original. We know he was reading the Lonely Hearts Killer book and getting off on that. And he was doing, who did he copy, Billy, with?
Well, he copied, he's pulling from, he's definitely
everybody.
Copying.
Yeah.
He's definitely copying Zodiac. He's definitely copying Son of Sam. He's giving clues to who he is inside this. He was a student of serial killers. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he was so much so that, you know, when he gives himself that nickname and then comes up with all these other nicknames that potentially he could, you know, he was getting off on not only the actual act of it, but people talking about him.
So one of the most chilling reveals that Dennis Rader made to Catherine Ramsland was that at the time of his arrest, he was actually actively planning to kill again. And he had made an attempt to kill again, similar to what he did to Anna Williams, which was one of his thwarted attempts in the 1990s. So Dennis Rader had even set a date. It was in October of 2004. And he'd been stalking a particular woman who was the object of his obsession. And he himself, so with Catherine Ramsland from jail, she wrote a book and he wrote a portion of it. And the portion he wrote included a description of his plans in detail. Quote, "This was supposed to be my opus, my grand finale. And to make it different, I would set the house on fire using propane canisters." And he said that he even went into this woman's backyard and knocked on her door, probably dressed as some serviceman for this ruse that he would do to get in the front door. And he bailed, similarly to what happened with Anna Williams, because a city street crew showed up unexpectedly to work outside the house on the roads. So he rescheduled, right? This is October. He planned to kill her the following spring. He would wait a couple months, but he was arrested in February. So his arrest ultimately saved this woman, because there's no doubt he's only failed once, when in the form of Catherine Bright's brother, Kevin, in the early 1970s. But there is this problem with what Dennis Rader says, right? This seems pretty fantastical. He's a pathological liar, so everything needs to be taken with a grain of salt. However, the police looked into this and they did find that a street crew had been set up in front of this woman's house on October 22nd of 04. So it's possible that like this is true. And I read a little bit more about this woman. So this didn't come out until Ramsland's book came out. And the police knew about it, but they didn't want to traumatize this woman because he had been so close to doing it. And he didn't want like the public airing of this to really f*** this woman up. But she did find out, and apparently Landwehr, the lead detective, was saying that she took it like a champ and this woman is a bad bitch and super tough. She's like, well, fuck it, he's in jail. I guess like what you don't know can't hurt you. And she didn't know that she was being stalked, but he had been stalking her for months and he would have kept going.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
So Dr. Catherine Ramsland, she's very close to my dad. She wrote a book that came out in 16. She actually got permission to interview him. And so it's kind of like this open book of my dad's brain. My dad actually wanted to do it to help, you know, educate and help catch people like him. But also he wanted the attention because he's a narcissist. And he also, and then the money went to the victims. So they had to approve it. The problem, I have read that book and I did use it for research and I have met her. She's extended a lot of like friendship and kindness to my dad. They talk on the phone a lot. They play chess and stuff. The thing is, my dad's a really like non-reliable narrator because he's a pathological liar. So anything that comes out of my dad's mouth, you have to like run it through. Is he lying? And so unfortunately, even though he thinks he's trying to help, like I threw that book across the room. The detective threw it across the room. Like it's a very, very difficult read. It has the crimes in it in a lot of detail. And then it has my dad basically throwing me under the bus at places, my mom under the bus. This is before my book came out. And so like, it's just my dad being that narcissistic a-hole BTK, you know? And so again, like, if that's the only person you've ever met after he was arrested, like the detectives and the criminologists, I would see where they would say this guy doesn't have anything else there. And so one of the reasons I wrote my book was to come back and say, okay, look, we've got this book about his crimes that Wichita Eagle did with the police. It's solid. It's really solid. Okay. There's other books out there that are total crap. That one's solid. And then we got Ramsland's, which is basically like BTK. And then we've got mine, and we've got Dad and Dennis Rader. And if you're going to learn about him and learn how to catch these guys, you got to combine all three.
Rader was charged and ultimately pled guilty to 10 counts of first-degree murder. And as part of his plea, he had to confess to his crimes in open court.
First of all, Mr. Otero was strangled, or a bag put over his head and strangled. Then I thought he was going down, and I went over and strangled Mrs. Otero. And I thought she was down. Then I strangled Josephine. I thought she was down. And then I went over to Junior and put the bag on his head. After that, Mrs. Otero woke back up, and, you know, she was pretty upset and what's going on. So I came back and, at that point in time, strangled her for a death strangle at that time.
With your hands or what?
No, with a cord, with a rope. And then I think at that point in time, I redid Mr. Otero, put the bag over his head, went over and then took Junior. Before that, she asked me to save her son. So I actually had taken the bag off, and then I was really upset at that point in time. So basically, when Mr. Otero was down, Mrs. Otero was down, I went ahead and took Junior. I put another bag over his head and took him to the other bedroom at that time.
What did you do then?
Put a bag over his head, put a cloth over his head, a t-shirt, and a bag so he couldn't tear a hole in it. And he subsequently died from that. And then when I went back, Josephine had woke back up.
What did you do then?
And I took her to the basement and eventually hung her.
All right, you hung her in the basement?
Yes, sir.
All right, did you do anything else at that time?
Yes, I had some sexual fantasies. But that was after she was hung.
From the public's perspective, the wheels of justice were slowly turning. But behind the scenes, Carrie's life was in emotional ruins.
Writing was the only way I could heal in a way nothing else could. Like, I had done everything. I had talked to therapists. I had church. I had my husband. I had my kids. Nothing healed me in the way that I needed to heal except writing, and that was a gift that was given to me. And so writing helped me find my dad, but it was like, it was a very cathartic process, but it gutted me. I mean, I basically shut down, left all of my normal life, and worked my butt off for 4 years so that I could heal and talk, because like 4 or 5 years ago, I couldn't even say BTK out loud. Like, I wouldn't be able to look you in the face. And so to get from that to where I can go on like primetime TV and do it or do it live, I had to put a lot of it, tucked it a lot of it away after my father went to prison in 2005. I didn't get into therapy till 2007. Like, I had bad PTSD. I thought I was going crazy. She's like, no, you have PTSD. So once she put a name to it, I realized I wasn't insane. You know, I thought I had gone insane. But I had tucked a lot of it away, or I could only process it in pieces, or I could only process it in therapy. It was a very long, like 10-year process, even before I spoke to the media. And then I kind of sort of just threw up when I did speak to the media, which I think you probably know is pretty common with like crime and trauma survivors. Like, we don't talk. And then when we do, we just don't stop talking. So after my story came out, then I had sent so many notes to this journalist at the Wichita Eagle. This big, huge piece came out in the spring of 15 called Forgiveness Isn't Tidy. And he told me I had sent him like 80 pages of notes, like just thanking, like answering questions. And the journalist was like, I think you're a writer. He's like, you think really well in your writing. Because I can express myself better in writing than I can speaking. And so I've had like criminologists and detectives tell me, like, they're using my book to teach in college. You know, I talked to like some criminal justice kids in New York. I talked to like 50 kids over Zoom recently about like victim advocacy. And I've got detectives telling me that they use my book now as a reference to profiling. So like, that's awesome. Like, I never expected anybody to care or that it would make an impact. And so I'm sort of like, I've only had one conversation ever with the FBI when he was arrested. And I'm like, why am I not sitting in Quantico talking to these people? You know, like, why am I not, like, why are people that caught D'Angelo, like, why aren't we all in there talk, like, comparing notes?
Carrie didn't speak publicly until 15 years after her father was revealed as BTK. And on the heels of another high-profile serial killer arrest in the form of Joseph D'Angelo, many have wondered if his daughters will decide to speak publicly as well. And when the news of the Golden State Killer's arrest was made public, Carrie instantly thought of them.
So when they caught Gold State, I was really thrilled that they had caught him, because I imagine that was like sort of that big white Moby white whale they would never catch, you know. And then I also found out then really quickly he had children, and I was devastated for them. I was bawling that night knowing that they were going exactly through what I was going through, you know, and not just that night, but knowing the rest of their lives, knowing here I am and how horrible it still can be. You know, I wouldn't wish my life on my worst enemy. And then to find out these innocent people were going to have to go through all this, you know, with the insane media, and the media around Golden State was even worse than BTK, because like there wasn't Facebook then, there wasn't Twitter then, you know. And so like we were harassed pretty bad by the media, but I can't even imagine what their family's been through.
It's no doubt and no surprise to hear that Carrie still deals with pain and heartache over the truth about her father every single day. But she's tried to channel her experience into some semblance of good.
What's it like to be the daughter of a serial killer? I mean, day to day, I'm pretty much a normal person. I mean, I try to be a mom, you know, I'm a writer, I'm a victim's advocate, you know, so I try to live a pretty normal life. Moving, you know, we've been more careful about privacy. So we run into some issues with privacy. You can run into issues with the schools. The schools do not do well when you tell them, like, you're the mom, like, you're the daughter of a serial killer. You know, they freak out on you. So, like, when we moved, we tried not to tell the schools. I mean, first, like, don't believe everything you hear in the news. I mean, they were saying I had kids. I didn't at the time. They were saying I had turned him in. I didn't turn him in. I mean, I did tell him about the eighth murder, but I didn't approach the police before he was arrested. And then they were saying that, like, my blood had turned, like they had taken DNA from me while they had gone to my college and got it. So I did learn that stuff later. But a lot of that stuff, especially early on when these cases come out, everybody wants everything. Don't believe a lot. Don't believe everything out there, because there's still stuff out there about it that's inaccurate. And then I think it's true, again, like with D'Angelo's daughters or any time this happens, like, you need to give the families privacy, like, leave them alone. Don't be trying to figure out who they are. If they want to talk, they will talk. And they have the right the rest of their lives not to talk, or they have the right to talk as much as they want. So I have the right to talk to not talk. And then I have the right to talk whenever I want. And because it heals me. But for other people that don't want to talk, they have the right to privacy. And so we're all going to like heal different, and we need to be patient with each other, like on our journeys, because none of us are in the same place.
In part one of this three-parter, we challenge you to be open-minded about this concept of empathy and whether or not it was possible for Dennis Rader to possess it selectively. And obviously, there's no way for us to ever know the answer to that for sure, because we can't get inside his head. And we can't believe a word he says, because he's a f***ing pathological liar. What we do know is that Dennis Rader, as BTK, was about as evil and cold as they come. And while serial killers are rare, they are profoundly effective at causing far-reaching misery. Misery so dense that it bleeds into the roots of communities and becomes a part of them. So the best we can do is hope to find balance and neutralize such evil with extreme compassion for one another, extreme camaraderie, extreme good, and as trite and cheesy as this is going to sound, extreme hope for healing. And this theme echoes a phrase we say often about the true crime genre as a whole. It's all about restoring order back from chaos.
And And a huge, huge thank you to Carrie for being our first degree for this episode. If you have a story you'd like to tell, no story is too small or insignificant. So please email us at hello@thefirstdegreepodcast.com. You can follow us on Instagram at Alexis Linkletter, at Billy Jensen, at Jack Vanek, at The First Degree. Please join our Facebook group by searching The First Degree on the search bar and stick around because we're going to kill some time and talk about our serial killer names.
And remember, only you can prevent serial killers and keep your friends close.
But not that close. Hey, Jack, why don't we go? You say one word, I say one word, and we bounce back and forth. You go, say but. Try it.
But.
Not.
That.
No. No. Start from the beginning.
So Billy starts?
No, you. But.
Okay. But.
Not.
That.
Close.
Nailed it.
Happy Chicken Wing Day. Sources for today's episode include The Wichita Eagle, Kansas.com, Rolling Stone, Court Documents, Psychology Today, and as always, our First Degree interview is always our largest source.
Oh boy. Welcome to another episode of Killing Time. I would just like to let everybody know that we have had so many technical difficulties today. It's like our first time recording all over again. I'm feeling nostalgic. How are you feeling, Alexis, with your microphone literally falling off?
I'm thinking it's time for new microphone stands for a remote recording, but I'm feeling really good today for once.
We've got some good vibes going on, guys.
We did. We had a nice few days, and it's all going to be okay, maybe.
Billy, how are you feeling? Your mustache is, and facial hair is looking fantastic.
And your hair is really long. You look kind of like a mountain man.
You look sort of like Devin Sawa.
I don't know who that is, but okay.
He was a heartthrob from the 90s, and he had a little bit of a long sort of a kind of swoop that you have going on. You look like a 90s heartthrob.
Okay. I wouldn't go that far. He looks like he's from the 90s.
You can't give me that much.
No.
Alexis is going to bite that right in the ass.
No, because Billy, then I'll start being like, oh, I'm handsome and famous and I'm
really
swole.
Beefy.
Like he gets his head gets too big if we give him even one compliment. So we got to keep it reined in.
Got to keep it reined in.
Billy, just remember, deep in your soul, I just gave you a compliment. Just keep it.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Deep in my soul, I'm still a really skinny kid that won't take a shirt off at the beach.
Aww. That's fine. Literally. I've given you plenty, so no compliments from me.
All right. Well, so this episode of Killing Time, you know, we finished our BTK three-parter, and we thought that we would, you know, dive into the world of nicknames. And all these serial killers have nicknames. Some are given to them. Some give themselves one. And I thought it would be funny if we asked our Facebook group what our serial killer nicknames would be. Have you either of you guys seen these?
Nope.
I have not seen them.
I didn't look on purpose because you told me not to because you wanted it to be funny.
Well, I knew you would spoil it if I didn't tell you not to. Okay, so are you guys ready?
Yes.
Ready.
First and most liked one from Jen, just for me, is Jack the Sipper.
Ooh, Jack the Sipper is good.
Right? I'm sipping right now.
You really are.
And you know what? I wanted to make my AIM screen name back in the day, maybe when I was 13 years old. I wanted to make it Jack the Ripper, but J-A-C the Ripper. Somebody had already taken it.
I love that. I love that. Jack the Sipper is better, so it's good you didn't do that one, so you can do this one.
Yeah.
Instead. Next comes from Shay, and she says, mine's Jack Attack. Alexis, obviously, the Tank, and Billy.
The Tank is not a serial killer name.
It's not, but Billy is just Slenderman.
Billy Slenderman Jensen has my vote.
It's pretty good. Okay, the next one. Let's see. Vanek the Vulture. This one comes from Lauren. Vanek the Vulture, Alexis Exfis. Nope, can't even pronounce that. Alexis Exfis.
Asphyxiator?
No, just asphyxiate.
Alexis asphyxiate? Is that it?
Yes.
It sounds like a perfume.
It sounds like they want me to asphyxiate.
Alexis asphyxiate. And Billy Phantasm.
Gross.
You don't like it?
I hate Billy's. Mine's cool because it sounds like she wants me to asphyxiate, which I'm fine with. And then, yeah, yours is good. All fine. I'll take them all.
Okay, Billy.
Except Billy's.
The next one. We're going to find Billy a good one by the end of this. This one comes from Camille. Billy is the dreadful detective.
That's pretty good. Mm. It sounds more like his pro wrestler name.
The dreadful detective, yeah.
Yeah.
How come there's not a –
And he wears a monocle. Why?
Hell yeah.
Why is there not
actually, it turns into a ninja star. The monocle. Do you guys remember Xena Warrior Princess? She had those razor sharp rings that she would throw and then come back to her after it sliced someone's head off. He has that, but it's a monocle, and then he has one that's a pocket watch, and he can also swing around on a chain and launch them.
Yes.
It kind of makes me think about like a Mortal Kombat character. Like that is like your choice
Finished
of weapon.
Him.
Yeah. Billy, do you like the Dreadful Detective, or are we going to keep moving?
I think that should be a WWE wrestling personality, the Dreadful Detective. There has not been a detective wrestler. There was Boss Man, who was a police guy, but there has not been a detective, so I'd like to see that.
Okay. Our next one comes from Ashley, and Alexis would be the Aperol Spritz Assassin.
Oh, hell to the... Yeah, Ashley.
Yes.
Have my back.
Yep. I would be the emo annihilator.
Yep.
Pretty tight. And Billy probably wouldn't get a name because everyone would just be like, yeah, okay, probably you should have seen that coming.
Yep.
Let's go to this. Meg says Jack is the scene slayer, Billy is the McDonald's murderer, and Alexis is the lizard lawbreaker or the amphibian arsonist.
Oh, yes. Nail it. People getting creative in quarantine.
We're
getting into this.
Really creative. Okay. Katie says Jack Attack. Okay. The stay awake pill killer, Alexis.
Hell yeah. killing all night and all day.
Yeah,
no sleep.
Maybe
for the wicked.
All your murders would be in the middle of the night because you're the only one awake. I guess a lot of murders are by serial killers are probably in the middle of the night, but.
And a lot of just random murders are caused by like meth fueled, upper fueled rages. So yeah, that makes sense.
Okay. Britton says some of these are, you know, just for one of us. Jack is the crop top killer. I don't hate it.
That's perfect.
Angie says Jack is the Vanic Panic, which I really like.
Wow.
It's almost like Satanic Panic. I'm feeling it. Alexis is the Meticulous Murderer.
Ooh.
That's good.
Sexy.
And Billy is the Small World Slayer, which I don't understand.
I'm into that.
Background, but I like
it.
It's a small world after all.
Yeah, it's for Disney. Yeah.
Wait, these are pretty good then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Next is somebody also said Billy is Slenderman. Alexis is the Alexis is the organized killer. I mean, look how she organizes the show, Bonnie says.
Yeah, yeah, Bonnie.
And then Jack is the mermaid killer. I get entranced when I listen to her talk, and I trust she is almost like how mermaids would lead sailors into bad places, and then bam.
Ooh.
I do not think that my voice is very nice to listen to, so thank you. My mom just texted me, and she has an idea. She says Billy needs to be the OP slasher, short for owl poem slasher.
May, come on.
Did May just text you that from the other room?
Yes. She's probably literally, I'm recording at my parents' house
right
now.
She's listening.
My mom is listening from the other side of the door, and she's like, I've got the answer.
She always does that, May.
She always does. Okay. Dara says Jack would be the punk rock punisher. Love it. Alexis is the type A terrorist. And
ooh,
Billy.
Okay. Wait. Wait a second.
Are you feeling this?
Jack, is that Instagram handle available? Because I feel like the type A terrorist is something that like resonated in a way that I never thought anything would or could.
I've never seen you so excited in anything in my entire life.
No. Type A terrorist. Oh, yeah.
But Alexis, you might be a little bit jealous of Billy's from Dara because his is the chicken nugget nightcrawler.
I'll take that.
If you can,
this is why me and Billy's relationship is so adversarial, because like that makes me hate you, Billy, because I want to be that.
I know. I knew this one would hurt you. And if anybody could see how wide Alexis's eyes got as I described that, I know you so well that I know that that nickname belongs to you. And a fun fact I learned about Alexis this weekend is that we had a getaway this weekend together and with Jared. And
I'm their daughter. I'm their daughter.
Family getaway.
Moral of the story.
And we're talking about when you're hungover, like everybody needs that one food, you know? And my food, for some reason, I need sushi and Alexis needs a nugget.
Yep.
Yeah. But here's the reason why. Here's the reason why Alexis is disqualified from any sort of nugget nicknames, because there are wonderful sauces you can use with the chicken nuggets, and Alexis prefers ketchup.
Yep. I also learned that.
You should have seen the heart attack I had when we got to the beach with our chicken nuggets. And I was like, where's the ketchup? And Jack's like, we have ranch, we have honey mustard, we have
barbecue. All the sauces.
No ketchup. I'm like, well, what's the point? It's not even worth it. I think I had like one because I was so sad there was no ketchup. It ruined the whole day.
That's the fun part about a nugget is you get all the sauces and you can dip from sauce to sauce to sauce. And maybe I'll do a ketchup, but I probably will do more of a barbecue or a ranch or a sweet and sour.
Or a hot mustard.
Honestly, you guys, it's not even worth it if there's not ketchup.
Okay. Next one is Nita says, Jack is the social influencer killer. Tight. Alexis is the SoCal tank. Do you like that one?
Yeah. Wait, no, but that sounds more like a fucking like, that sounds, you know how like Heidi Klum is like the body? Like that sounds more like a like my, some other like hot girl, hypothetical hot girl name. The SoCal tank is like cool. Yeah. She's a cool chick.
Definitely.
Whoever that is. It's not me, but it could be.
Okay. And then Billy is the investigative murderer. And then this is one I like from Alyssa. You guys, if we were like a team, we would just be Jab.
Jab is perfect.
And Billy, this is now, this is the my favorite name. The McMurderer.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
I mean,
that's really good.
Is anything more perfect?
Or it could be the, what's like a wordplay on the hamburglar, ham murderer?
Hamburglar is pretty much it.
I gotta think this through. I'll revisit this some other time after I've ruminated on that.
Circle back in about a week when you don't get any sleep and you just think about this.
Yeah, exactly.
Marie says Billy could be the original Slender Man, just like GSK was the original Night Stalker. Right?
Absolutely.
I kind of like that one the best.
Honestly, like, has anyone seen Salad Fingers?
Yes.
Billy's Salad Fingers.
I feel like I have salad fingers sometimes. I have very
but Billy, like,
fingers.
Billy's, like, body type and, like, height and, like, gangly sort of vibe and, like, black and white and, like, he doesn't like salad, which makes it ironic.
I'll eat a salad if it has steak in it.
And french fries and no lettuce.
Yeah.
Yeah, and like buttered rice.
I was going to say, and spaghetti.
Can you throw in some buttered rice in there and some spaghetti?
Billy, we ordered that from that Japanese sushi place once, and he got spaghetti. That came with your steak.
That was when we first started recording. So it was when I was first starting to get to know you, Billy. And I was like, this is a very, this is a
odd
choice.
Move.
It's a choice. Mm-hmm. You still stand by it?
I still stand by it. I stand by all my dietary choices.
Sometimes I'm like, Billy, what are you doing? And he's like, I'm eating a piece of chicken I just took out of the microwave. I'm like, a piece of chicken? He's like, yeah, it was frozen. I'm like, ew, like a frozen piece of chicken that you threw in the microwave? He's like, it's breaded. I'm like, oh, that's better.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yep. Okay. Funny. You guys, there's a few more left. And then I think we're good. Caitlin says, I'm the festival fatale. Love it. Chooses victims based on headliners. Alexis is the SoCal siren, lures men down to the Marina Beach. And then you can just like stay at my apartment when you're done. Right?
Yes.
And then Billy is the Disney dark prince, leaves a Mickey moniker on all of his victims.
Ooh. Yes.
It's pretty good.
Treen says Billy is the owl ornament offender.
Mm-hmm.
I like that one.
Never going to live that down, the owl poem.
Jack is, so these are all alliterations. Jack is the spritz stain strangler, which I do appreciate because I do spill all of my drinks. And Alexis is the LA lockdown lunatic.
Yeah, that one wins. Dude, I feel seen for the first time in a long time.
Wow.
That one's you.
Wow. Yeah, this is really solid.
It's teaching us a lot about ourselves.
And each other and all of you, we thank you for.
And you guys know us so well.
Mm-hmm. Dude, the LA lockdown lunatic is like reverberates into my soul and into the soul of all my ancestors. All right. Well, you guys did an amazing job. I think we should call it. We're at 14 minutes and 30 seconds.
Beep. Beep, beep, beep.